life can get pretty complicated. In the Simply Practically Human podcast, Mark Lebusque talks to incredible humans to see the way forward more clearly through the complexity in the world and in our heads. Let's get ready to thrive.
Well, g'day there, fellow humans. Mark Lebusque here again for an episode of the Simply Practically Human podcast and another experimental effort. You could call it a self-indulgent one because I'm indulging with self again today, just me running a podcast where I'm going to just wax lyrical on a few different topics, hopefully some things that you will be able to associate yourself with, and I hope be able to look into your mirror a little bit and just wonder if there's some things that you're doing today that are useful for you, and that there may be some things that you're doing today, the way that you're turning up, the way that you're interacting with other humans, that may not be useful for you at the time. So as part of my experimental series, and I say that, I see my work, I see my life as an experiment, and this is part of the experiment. It is, can you do these self-indulgent podcasts? Will people listen to them? By the way, thank you for the feedback on my first self-indulgent one where I shared with you the I told you so's and got some lovely feedback from people who said things like, you must have been thinking about me at the time when you wrote that, or you must have been thinking about someone that I know. Usually we hear it's thinking about someone that you know, when it's really just code for you must have been thinking about me, because that's exactly what I do. So as I continue to use my life, my work, my podcasts, my books, my programs as what I call an experimental or learning laboratory, we'll kick into it again today. So where am I going to start today? I'm going to start with getting you to task your mind into, I guess, who you hang around with. Who is it that you hang out with? Who are the people that you tend to hang around with? If you think about it a bit more deeply than, not deeply, now at the moment, as we know in the lockdown capital of the world, Melbourne, Australia, we don't tend to hang out with too many people other than maybe one or two other people in our house. But in those times when we could be out and about, interacting human to human, just spend a moment thinking about who is it that you're drawn to? Who is it that you're attracted to? I'm not seeing much meaning from a physical, romantic sense there, but those people, sometimes we hear it called like-minded people. Why have you chosen that particular group or that particular person? Also maybe thinking a bit about how our hardwiring comes into this. And as a social species, we like to be connected. We like to belong. And we may even like to be liked, which is an interesting concept in itself, because we humans not just like to be liked, I think we love to be liked. And that also has something to do with us working out who we're going to hang around with. So we're going to look at this topic today, and I wanted to start with a quote from C. Joy Bell C., who says, life begins when we get tired of our own bullshit. We must also get bloody tired of our own bullshit in order for our lives to begin. So what does she mean by that? So let me introduce you to what I call the three D's. And this idea that came about for me when I was walking on stage one day at a International Women's Day event in Melbourne many, many years back. And I'm sure some others can relate to this as well, particularly those who may suffer from a bit of imposter syndrome, or maybe at times a little bit of that curse of public speaking. I can remember walking up onto the stage, and just as I'm walking up there, this is the first time it ever happened for me, because usually I'd be really, really worried about what people would think about me, what they might be saying about me, what they might come up and say to me later on. And I heard this voice that said, some people are going to think you're amazing, and some people are going to think you're an absolute dickhead, and they're both right. So some people are going to think you're amazing, Mark. Some are going to think you're an absolute dickhead, and they're both right. What I then reflected on was who out of those two groups are the ones I'm most likely to hang around with? And it'd be no surprise to you all, and I'm sure you can ask yourself the same question. My answer would be the first group, the people who absolutely love me, the people who think I'm amazing, the people who think everything that I say is some sort of human gospel about how they should be as human beings and all the things they should be doing. And I tend to not hang around too much with those people who think that I'm somewhat of a dickhead or may have different views to me. So the three D's, what are they? They stand for disciples, doubters, and detractors. So I look at these three different groups and just share a little bit with you today around why it's important for us to not get too caught up in hanging around one of those too much in favor of the others, why it's important to hang around each of them, but also the benefits of hanging around each, but also some of the downfalls of hanging around each of those three D's. That's the disciples, the doubters, and the detractors. So let me give you a little bit of an overview of each. So let's start with the first one. It's interesting when I hear these words, which is people say we try and hang around people that are a bit like-minded. So you could, in some respects, categorize the first D, disciples, in that area. These are the people who, when you post something on LinkedIn, they always seem to give you a like, and some of them may even put a comment in and let you know about how good you are and how amazing and inspirational and all of those things that you are. And, you know, that's a lovely, lovely way to boost your confidence, help you to be in a situation where you feel that you're bringing something to the world. So it's a really good place to be. And so these sorts of people, they tend to, by definition, are known to embrace and assist in spreading the teachings of another. So these types of people are really getting a lot out of what you're saying. And not only that, they're going to that extra step and they're starting to share that with other people. So, you know, we think about LinkedIn, we think about any other sort of form of social media, and you know, so many forms these days. There's so many ways to get the message out, and these disciples will be helping you to get your message out. These people really give you confidence that your message is on point, and you can feel in some respects that you're loved by others and fated universally. As I think about it, when I think about these disciples, for me, in some respects, it's become like a bit of a drug of dependence, which shows up as a like or a share, a glowing comment about the virtues of one's expertise. So the upside of this, I think, is it gives you confidence to continue to, I guess, have the energy, the courage, whatever we want to call it, to put your thoughts out into the world, knowing full well that there will be some people out there who will be sharing that message, agreeing with that message, and helping you to build your profile, your confidence, your sense of self-esteem, your sense of worth, all of these sorts of things. So I think there's a really big upside to having disciples, but also be thinking about this. What's the potential downside? What's the potential downside of everyone loving what you do? Nobody challenging what you're saying, maybe asking a question, or maybe it's sometimes telling you that you are totally off track. And I think this is where that quote comes back in. We can be seduced in believing our own bullshit if we spend too much time with our disciples. And it really narrows our capacity for real learning and effectively shuts out the important skills of embracing different perspectives that can challenge your beliefs, your values, and your behaviours. So something that you need to be considering, and I think this is for everyone to take a moment and reflect, is when I am surrounded by so many disciples, what is it starting to do to my ability to see another way, to accept and value another person's perspective, the diversity that might come with that, and what am I missing out on? Because what the disciples are going to do, they're going to blow smoke up your ass, and they're going to numb that sense of what is real versus what you may be seeing through your own rose-colored glasses that you start to wear. When I say you start to begin bathing comfortably in your own bullshit. So there's a great upside around the confidence and the self-esteem and these sorts of things. And I think it's important for human beings, as the way we're hardwired, we love status, we like a bit of hierarchy, we love to build our confidence, and we love to belong. But the downside of just embracing the disciples is that we start to believe in our own bullshit too much, and we start to miss out on embracing and understanding other human beings. So that's the disciples area. That's number one. So just have a think about that. Are you relying too much on the disciples? Are you relying too much on hanging out with the like-minded folk? And if you are doing that, start to think about perhaps how much of a limitation that's putting on your ability to grow, to learn, to develop, and to experiment and explore and to become different. So number two are the doubters. This is a really, really critical group of human beings that you should, if you're not, start to spend a bit more time in embracing. So by definition, the doubters are known to be uncertain about something. They'll be undecided in opinion or belief, a feeling of uncertainty about the truth, reality, or the nature of something. I tend to look at these people in an upbeat way, as the curious souls. These people have a level of curiosity that is really, really helpful for not just them, but for others, because they will ask the second and third and fourth and fifth question. So their curiosity challenges you to create a clearer message in what you're trying to say. And I always hear, you know, that famous quote that if a seven-year-old can't understand what you're saying, well, then it's too complicated and perhaps you don't know what it is yourself. And this gives us, I guess, this idea that if we start to embrace the doubters, what it allows for us to do is it sort of gives us a chance to look back into our own mirror when they ask questions and dig a bit deeper. Don't just go for that sort of superficial, scratch-the-surface answer, because the doubters are looking for more from that. The doubters aren't people that are going to be there to shout you down. You need to start to look at the doubters, that they are there in order to help you to step out of your rightness, to step out of your expertise, to slightly jolt you out of those areas. And even though at the time it might feel a little bit like, maybe you feel like you're getting attacked because they aren't getting it. Or the other thing is you might be starting to turn it back on them that they don't get what you're saying. So it becomes their problem and not your problem. I think you just want you to lift yourself out of that and just understand that the doubters are really there because they crave, through their curiosity, more information in order to make sense of the world that they live in, or in this case, the message that you've offered up. So we must spend time in accepting that the doubters need you to fill some gaps in to the information that you're sharing with them so they can start to make sense. And this is a huge part of this idea of why we should embrace the doubters, because this gives us a chance to help people to make sense of our message. And there are many times, and I'm sure you're like this as well, where because you've been saying the message for so long, it absolutely makes sense to you. So you can struggle then to understand why is it that it doesn't make sense to them if it makes sense to me. And that's because you haven't filled enough gaps in for them. So they will ask you the second, third, and fourth question, and it gives you a chance to step into a little bit of patience and some tolerance and some understanding of them to then start to fill into those gaps and to step out of your laziness of your rightness and your expertise, because they're less reluctant to be seduced by your bullshit, and they are more willing to ask you those questions. So please embrace these people. Don't see them as fence sitters. Don't see them as people that are trying to just swing in the breeze and not really work out where they want to go. Look at them as curious souls. So is there a downside to the doubter? I think this is where intention comes in. And I think intention comes into to these three, but in particular in this place here. Is there intention to be curious, to fill in those gaps, to make sense, to understand more, to help you to challenge your beliefs and your behaviours? Or if we looked at it another way, is there intention just to continue to ask questions to basically wear you out? And you would have come across these sorts of people at times, and they frustrated the hell out of me, and they still do. But that person that just keeps asking questions, but why, but I don't understand, but could you tell me more? Mark, what do you mean by that? Yeah, but can you give me a bit more? I don't quite understand it yet. There are some people whose intention to play the game of the doubter may be more based around procrastination and stalling. And perhaps some of these people lack the courage to make a decision or go a certain way. So they will just continue to ask questions and ask questions and ask questions. And at times, you know, we call that analysis by paralysis. But I need to know more. I need to know more. I need to know more. So in that situation, what you need to be conscious of is perhaps turning it around the other way and you becoming curious and becoming curious with those people about, well, why is it that you need to know more? To try and get to some sort of common ground here, somewhere in between that curiosity with good intention and perhaps that curiosity or that procrastination or that fence sitting with a less than good intention, just to keep things exactly how they want things to be. So this is a great opportunity in this space for you to, I guess, start to take that step towards the third group, which is the group that I've found a really, really challenging one to deal with. And I think all humans do, because we get caught up in the game of rightness. We get caught up in the game of our ego and wanting to be right and wanting to look smart and have the answers. And then all of a sudden, there's this third group comes along called the detractors. And by definition for this one, they are known to be the person who disparages someone or something or finds fault in everything another human being or another party says. So as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about people. I'm also thinking about myself as well here, and I'll share some stories around how it's worked for me. But these people are, I guess, always seen as our greatest enemy, and I think we need to start to change our mindset around, I wonder if we could move away from them being our enemy to being something else, to being something that helps us to see what we can't see. So in this space here, again, intention comes into it in a big way, but this is where you're starting to get your expertise, or, you know, these amazing words, your thought leadership starting to be challenged. It's an interesting term in itself, thought leaders. There are many of them out there. But this is where what I call severe expert discomfort comes in, and it can raise its ugly head in the tension of rightness, and it really starts to cloud the landscape. And the perspectives are at odds, and the tension is high because your belief systems are poles apart. And also we can start to think that our behaviours are poles apart as well. So I sort of look at it like this. If you thought about it like a weather system, it's like the storm clouds start to form, and there is a really big chance of unexpected lightning strikes. And the detractors are really, really good at that. That's what I would consider. You just, when you least expect it, the detractors turn up and they will unleash that unexpected lightning strike that will stop you in your tracks. Because what you're looking for at the time is, I'm going to call it the dry alcove, that place where you can be, where you're hanging out with your disciples, everything's going well, everything's working beautifully for you. And at that time, you're not getting that. You are not getting those signals that people are liking or they're embracing you. In fact, the sorts of things that you're going to get are folded arms, tightly clenched fists. There'll be an absence of active listening. There will be listening to respond rather than listening to learn in that space where you become face-to-face with your detractors. But I want you to think about this. So what is the benefit of having the detractors? So if I share a story now, a quick story that, you know, obviously I'm very much into humanizing workplaces. And I know that I'd got so caught up in my old bullshit about that, that I wouldn't open my eyes up to the people who spoke more about if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, or more so, they would say things like, yeah, but that's just all warm, fluffy, you know, kumbaya, Mark. Here we go again. The story of kumbaya, Mark is a famous story that I used to get regularly thrown at me, and it would knock me off balance. And it would get me to put my walls up and it'd get me to dig in even harder at people because I wanted to convince them of the rightness of going down the human pathway. So you're literally shutting off another perspective here. Here's someone who says to people, you should be listening to others' perspectives in order to grow and learn and explore. But here I was shutting them down. And that would work in a few different ways. The real way would be that I would become aggressive, and I would become aggressive because I wanted to convince them of my rightness. Or I may even become silent, depending on who was in the room at different times, not so much today, but back in my time in corporate, depending on what level of the hierarchy was in the room, even though you didn't agree with them and you were poles apart, you would just accept it and move on. Maybe go and have a coffee with someone and then bitch and piss and moan about them. Or, yeah, you just sort of brush it off and just go about what you did. And what I've been able to learn by listening to my detractors, by listening to those people who say it's all about the KPI sheet, it's all about the numbers, it's always been this way, that it's all about the technical work, it's all about the policy, it's all about the procedure, it's all about the process. What I was able to start to understand was that what if we could bring the technical work together with the human work? So this is where it's helped me to start to change my perspective and think about the power of not just one of those things. So being very binary, it's either or, but it's, as Gerard Penner, a good friend of mine, says, the power of and. And this ability of bringing these two things together. But I wouldn't know that unless I was prepared to have conversations with detractors and then start to listen to them without shutting them down straight away, because what I was trying to do was to convince myself and others of my rightness, of my thought leadership, of all of this stuff that I'd learned, of my expertise. And in some respects, I think about the title expert or the title thought leader, and much of this, I think, is self-appointed titles, that when we start to really believe our own bullshit and we get caught in this space of that I'm right, that we start to put these labels on ourselves. So if you think about the detractors, there's great opportunities, there's a great upside in having you have to think really, really deeply about something that you believe in really strongly, that maybe there's some other things you can add to that, some other data points, some other opinions, some other perspectives that can help to round you out and make you a more useful human being, whether it's working in your organization, whether it's working with your clients, whether it's talking to someone in your family, in your community, that can help you to do that. But there's also the downside of detractors. And if you continue to get too many detractors, or if you keep hanging around people who continue to find fault in everything that you say, because you're a human being, at some point in time, this will start to open up that big door again for your imposter syndrome to show up and to continue to tell you that, yep, you're not smart enough and you haven't done enough and you didn't think of this and you didn't think of that and you were wrong. So that'll jump in really quickly. It'll start to impact on your self-esteem. It'll start to impact upon your self-worth. It'll start to move you into a place of self-loathing because you've just spent so much time, I guess, being downtrodden by others. So you need to be careful of spending too much time with detractors, but at the same time, you've got to be careful of spending no time with detractors as well, because if you don't, you don't get that chance to grow. So they're the three D's. I want you to think about, where do you spend most of your time now? And so have a think about it like this. On my website, there is a editable template, which is called Identify Your Three D's. It's at www.marklabus.com. You can find it there. And basically, it gives you a chance to sit down and reflect and sit down on your own and pick five disciples and a little message as to why. Pick five people who are doubters and also think a bit more deeply about why that is, and then pick five detractors. And again, sitting with that resistance on those people and thinking about, why is it you think that they detract? You're not trying to convince yourself of your rightness here. You're trying to get on the other side of that and think about, why is it that I have these detractors? I want you to think about how you feel when you think about each of these people and why you feel like that. And then here's a really nice piece of work that you can do, again, to continue to grow yourself, is to pick one of those people in each list, make contact with them, and start a conversation. So I know the easy one's going to be the first one. You'll go to your disciples, find someone who likes a lot of what you do, have a conversation. They will make you feel really good. And that's not a bad thing. We like to have that little bit of injection of confidence and the self-esteem. The ego gets a bit of a stroking there. But then think about the doubters. And who's that person that you're going to go and reach out to and start a conversation with them about, what is it that they don't understand? What is it that what they want to make more sense of? What is it that they are curious to know more about that you could help them with? And they could help you with their curiosity. And then that last group, the detractors, and this one will burn a bit, you know, think about that person that you'd really like to reach out to, the person that has a very, very different view to you, and it could be on a whole lot of different things. You see how polarized we are in the world today with a whole lot of stuff that's going on. Whether it's in the world, whether it's vaxxers or anti-vaxxers, or it could be a whole lot of different things. And we're seeing in our state at the moment, protests versus no protests. There's such polarity at the moment that you seem to be on one side or the other, but getting a chance to have a conversation with someone to understand a little bit more about why they are at the other end of the scale, and then they understand why you're there. It doesn't mean you have to agree. It just means you have to listen and learn to understand. So there's a little activity you can do using the three D's. And here's some questions for you to think about as well. First one is, how much time do you allocate across these three areas? If you were just to give a rough percentage, how much time do you think you allocate to disciples, to doubters and detractors? Why have you made those choices? Get underneath your justification here and start to look at yourself and look deeply into why that is. Perhaps it's because the level of comfort is greater when I start at disciples. The level of discomfort is much greater when I head towards detractors. Maybe there's a level of frustration with those that are doubters. Is this an unconscious or a conscious choice for you? Are you serving yourself or are you serving others by staying with one group as against staying with the other groups? And the other question to think about finally is, how important is it for you to be right, and even more, to be liked? And what's the difference between being liked and being respected? So that's the three D's. Having a think about the three D's is the place I wanted to kick us off today, which I guess then moves us into, or moves me into, another conversation around, because we do like to be liked, I say we do a lot of things for applause, where we should be thinking more about, are we doing it for a cause? So I want to take you down the pathway now of sharing with you a personal story, and again, then looking at it from a workplace perspective, or it could be workplace, it could be out of workplace, but more so from that workplace perspective, and what are the things we're doing to get applause, and what are the things we're doing because we have a strong feeling towards a cause there. So I call this story my fish ponds and fuse box story, and it relates to back in the early 90s when I was living in Adelaide in South Australia, in Australia, and as a young manager, young executive at the time, had just purchased my first house with my wife, Alison. Still married, just about to clock up 30 years of marriage on November 16th this year. But we just bought our first house. And I think it was perhaps 91. Interest rates at the time, people will freak out on this, were about 18%. And we had borrowed to the maximum that we could with a small deposit. And we bought ourselves a lovely little sandstone fronted house, maybe 60, 70 years old, in a suburb just out of the city of Adelaide. And even though we weren't flush with cash, we were pretty good at using credit and credit cards at the time. So one of the things we started to do was to start to spend money we didn't have, and I'm sure a few of you can relate to this, on making some cosmetic changes to the place. And when I look back on this now, I know it was something we wanted to do because we wanted the house to look better. But when I look back on it now, I think, who were we doing it for? The easy answer for that is we were doing it for us. But if I wanted to dig a bit deeper under that, we were doing it for others. And I'm going to say we were doing it for the applause. So here's some things that we did. We lifted some carpet up and replaced it. Painted the house on the inside, some nice new freshly painted colours on the inside of the place. We had the old wooden windowsills, so we had sanded them back, and I can tell you that took a lot of my patience and a bloody lot of time to get them back to their original wood, and, you know, sanding after sanding after sanding till my hands, which I call piano playing hands, never done a hard day's labour in their life. Certainly felt it when we were doing that. And we stained them back up to look pretty incredible. So the windowsills and the timber windows, new curtains. Another thing we did at the time, even though we couldn't afford them because we got them on a 5-year interest-free deal, was that we bought some Bose speakers that we could attach to the wall. Now, we couldn't afford that. At the same time, we bought ourselves a nice new big screen TV, flat screen TV, although not really flat screen because back then they had a big box on the back of them, but a big TV just in time for the Cricket World Cup so we could, again, impress people with our big TV and our speakers. So we put them up. We'd have parties. People would come around. They would see them. People would come into our house and they'd be like, oh, you've done a great job, and it makes you feel good. But we were looking for the applause. But the really big thing that I did at the time, and back in the early 90s, it was pretty cool to have one of these. I decided that it would be a great idea to construct an outdoor fish pond in my front yard. Yep, that's what I said, an outdoor fish pond in the front yard. So I started digging a hole one weekend. And then after about 8 weekends, I finished, and this thing was majestic. It had 3 or 4 different levels on it. We'd even been able to find a cement colouring called billabong to make it look like a nice old outback billabong. We put some lovely moss rocks around the outside and concreted them in as well. So this thing looked amazing. Filled it up with water, put the water plants in it, put the fish in it. And because I'd never done a hard day's labour in my life and I had no idea what I was doing with concreting and stuff, I didn't realise that you had to let the concrete sit for a while. So once we put the fish in and we put them in too early and the concrete hadn't cured, you can imagine what might have happened to the fish. They weren't doing all that well the next morning when I went out to have a look. We'd also put a lovely bench seat there as well. So you imagine that people were walking past our house. They could see through the trees at the front, and they could see this amazing fish pond. And what used to happen was that we'd get knocks on the door. And I'd open the door and someone would say, like, "That's an amazing fish pond you've got there. And who built it?" And I'd be very, very proudly, "Well, that was me." Now, with a lot of help from some friends as well at the time. So I would regale in the applause. I would go and stand out the front and I would tell people very proudly about what I'd done. Not a bad way to be, but it was all about looking at myself. So it was what I call the look at me style. Interestingly, inside the house, and it was an older house, and, you know, the way that it was built the 60 or 70 years ago wouldn't be the way you'd build a house today. But we had a fuse box which had all of the wiring and all the fuses and all of the things that kept the lights on and all of the heating happening and all these things. That was actually in our kitchen. And it was in an old wooden box. So you couldn't see it. It was out of sight. It was out of mind. Every now and again, you'd have to open it up because maybe a fuse had blown and some lights weren't working. So you'd replace the fuse, the old style fuses, the old style fuse wire. I remember very, very distinctly opening that box and the creaking sound it would make, the dead spiders that would be in there, the old bits of wire. But because this thing, this fuse box, was out of sight and out of mind, we didn't bother about it too much. Well, I didn't bother about it too much. I can't say that for Alison, but I didn't bother about it too much because it wasn't there to impress people. It was there to do a job. It was, I guess, serving the cause or the purpose to keep this house heated, lit up, a whole lot of different things. And you can only imagine what happened one night about 2 o'clock in the morning when we were woken by the smell of dirty smoke, like plastic was burning. There was dirty, thick black smoke coming through the house. And sure enough, the thing that we'd spent no time on, because it wasn't going to get us any applause, but it had a really strong cause in the house or a purpose, had caught on fire. It had sparked and caught fire. So in a bit of a panic, and I think I was first out the door, survival of the fittest, I'm going to say, or just survival for me, my survival mechanism kicked in. We got some animals outside. We went out the front. We called the fire brigade and they were able to come in and we put the fire out. So it didn't burn the house down, but here's what happened. All of those wonderful things were done. The carpets, the curtains, the paint job on the walls, all of those things had been impacted by the smoke and the dirty stench that was there. So all of the things were done to gain applause had been impacted by the very thing that we should have done something about, but we didn't. So what's my point here and how does this relate to the workplace or anything else you might be asking? Or maybe you're listening to it and going, that sounds like me. That's the sort of thing I do. I spend a lot of time in the look at me space. Look at me, look at what I'm doing, applaud me, reward me. And at the same time, your version of the fuse box that you know about, that you're doing nothing with, you know at some point in time that something's going to go wrong, but you just put it off and you leave it and you procrastinate and do nothing about it. So, having a think about this, fellow humans, what are the things you do today to get applause, whether they're in the workplace, whether they're at home, whether they're in your community, they might be in your local club that you go to, whatever environment you find yourself in. What are the things you are doing to get applause or the things you're doing to become what I call a look at me human? Now, this isn't to say that you shouldn't do things at times where people can see the value that you bring. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is when you continue to do this because you feel like this is the way for you to stand out, the way for you to get noticed, the way for you to get promoted, the way for you to move ahead of one of your peers in the organization, the way for you to be liked, the way for you to be accepted, the way for you to feel like you're connected and belong. But when you sort of know, a lot of that stuff can be very, very superficial. So one thing I used to do in the workplace to get applause and to play the look at me game is when a new manager would start and my results were going well, I'd tend to have them up on the wall. So if that new manager walked in, they would see a lovely graph there that Mark had drawn up with 40% ahead of target, whatever it might be. And they would see it and then they would be like, hey, that's a great job. So that was a great way for me to stand out. There's a whole lot of things that happen today, I think, that we do that are there for us to get applause and not necessarily for the cause. And I just wanted to share a few of them and maybe, again, you'll relate to these. And maybe while I'm saying these, in your own little checklist in your head, tick the box to say, yep, I do that, or no, I don't do that. So here's a couple of them. First one is just calling unnecessary meetings because you can. Because you're the boss and you can call meetings and you have meeting after meeting after meeting and you sort of feel important and it's your right to do it and it's a bit of a look at me moment because you can do lots of the talking. So there's the first one, unnecessary meetings, which flows into a second one that I say is writing unnecessary reports. So there's so many bits of work that we have done forever, so we keep doing them, or we create a report or a paper or something or a PowerPoint pack to stand out. You know, back in the 90s for me, the PowerPoint packs were big when you used to put the sound effects in them. You know, we've come a long, long way since then, but that was the big thing. Put fancy sound effects in, impress people, be applauded in the room for your creativity and the way you're doing things differently. Or that report that you write that no one ever reads, but you keep doing it because you feel like it makes you look important, that it makes you look relevant. It's another thing that we do. So there's reports, there's meetings, there's emails at all hours of the night and day. In fact, I know we can set our computers up now. I found this out from somebody else because I'd never done it, to send emails at certain times so we can impress other people. And even for those I've spoken to about this who in some organisations they work in where the technology is set up so they can't send emails at certain times, they've found ways to hack into that so they can still do that so they look like they stand out. I think busyness is a fish pond. Our incredible urge these days to tell people before they ask us that we're busy, that we're flat out, that we're in back-to-back meetings. It's almost like a badge of honour. I'm relevant. I'm needed because if I'm not all these things and if I'm not busy and people don't think I'm busy, what's going to happen to me? Maybe I'll become another one of those statistics, another one of those victims of the next restructure, the next right size of our organization. So there's a few things that we do that I think in the workplace are fish ponds. We're doing these things, we're building these fancy fish ponds, I call them, in order to get applause, to stand out, or to play the game of what I call the look at me manager. And then I look on the other side of it and I think about the fuse boxes and the things that are happening day to day, whether it's in your organization or outside your organization, whether you're a manager or you're not a manager, it doesn't matter. You can still do these things. And I think about the things that we don't think too much about because out of sight, out of mind, even though we say we've got a cause for those sorts of things and it could be about the way that we treat our people, the people are the most important part of our business. We've got these values, a whole lot of things that we say, there's some sort of cause there that's bigger than getting the applause, but we tend not to get applauded for doing these things because we don't seem to stand out as much. So what sort of fish pond activities am I talking about here? So the first one I'm going to say is spending one-to-one time with your people. If you are a manager, not cancelling those one-to-ones all the time because something else came up, had to do something for the boss, there was an important report I had to write, had to go to a meeting that was called at the last minute. Perhaps they call them, I think they call them, I had to go to a business critical meeting. So I can't catch up with you for your one-to-one. Even though I've cancelled the last 3 weeks, we'll catch up at some point in time. That creates a little spark in the fuse box. And the spark is by way of someone at the other end of that not feeling like they're important to you, feeling demotivated, feeling disengaged, disenfranchised because that very time that you'd set to spend with them, you've decided that there's something more important and you continue to do that And every time you do it, a little spark goes off. A little spark happens in that relationship there. So there's a good example of a fish pond. And I know from my experience that that is a very, very common one. It's something that happens a lot. Other types of fish pond activities that can happen as well would be like just the way that you play one person off against another. Favoritism, nepotism maybe. A whole lot of different ways that little things that you do, and it's always related to people. Saying that people are our most important thing, but not behaving in that way. Telling your people you have their back and that we've got these certain values on the wall, but when push comes to shove, you're not living them. And you're giving very clear examples of how you're not walking the talk. And again, we see a spark. We see a spark in the fuse box. And if you think about that from an engagement perspective, and there's always this sort of holy grail of business life is that we get our engagement scores up and they don't seem to be getting any better. And I guess my view on that is that because we spend so much time building fish ponds and so little time on tending to the fuse box, and the fuse box is usually where the people are, that we shouldn't be surprised when we come to our 6-monthly or 12-monthly engagement survey that people are disengaged. Engagement globally hasn't materially improved in 40 years, but we've spent a lot of money in personal development, whether it be for emerging leaders, long-term leaders, just anyone in an organization. We spend billions of dollars in order to become more effective so we can drive things like engagement up, employee satisfaction, employee engagement, productivity, efficiency, all of these things. But we very, very rarely in those sessions dig too deeply into the fish pond. The other fish pond work that we don't do, and the one that I'll finish up on today, is the work of self. Because that's some of the hardest work we need to do. So the very first piece of fish pond work you should be doing is looking back at yourself and having a conversation with yourself around what are the things I'm doing today to get applause, and which of those should I hang on to and do because they're useful, but how much of it is too much? And how often am I engaging in that activity at the expense of looking at the fuse box and what I bring to that? So do I live the values or do I just espouse the values? Am I walking the talk? Am I building trust? Do I trust myself? Do I trust the way that I turn up every day? That's fish pond work in itself. What are you doing about trusting yourself so that you can then give that trust to others? Are you giving people trust or are you expecting them to earn trust from you? There's an important part of, I guess, the foundations of building that amazing fish pond is about starting with yourself. So my challenge to you in regards to cause and applause is to stop in the moment and start with yourself and write yourself a little list on an A4 sheet of paper. One side of it could be, these are my fish ponds. These are my personal fish ponds. And these are the things that I get applause for and make me feel good. These are the things in my fuse box about myself. It could be your self-limiting beliefs that keep coming up, those bad news stories out of your bad news filing cabinet that keep popping up that you need to work through, removing some of those so you turn up as a better human being, understanding that the work in the fuse box is hard work, but it is for a cause. So where are you at there? Fish ponds or fuse boxes? Something for you to think about. So today we've covered off on a couple of things here. The first one is the three Ds. It's disciples, doubters, and detractors. And I want you to be thinking about doing that little exercise, reflecting upon where you're spending time, reflecting upon how that's impacting on you being able to experiment, explore, and grow as a human being, or as a manager, whatever it might be, a leader in your community, do that little activity, identifying your 3Ds, and spend some time understanding why you choose to spend so much time in one area, and then pick one person from each area and spend some time talking to them about why are you a disciple? So that reinforces some of the work you're doing. Why are you a doubter? So that gives you a sense of whether you're making sense or not, or whether you are stepping into curiosity or hanging on to your expertise, or why are you a detractor? And how that can open your mind up to understanding that it's not about rightness. It's about accepting different perspectives, different beliefs. It doesn't mean that you have to be their best friend and you have to be liked, but you can respect where they come from and they can respect where you come from. And perhaps you might even find out, and I think this is one of the most powerful parts of leadership, is at times when you realize that your perspective is not as useful as it might have once been, and perhaps someone else's perspective is going to help you make the progress that you want to. And then there's the fish ponds and fuse boxes. So spending that time thinking about how much time you play as a look at me manager, building fish ponds, hanging new curtains, painting the house, all of these sorts of things, and not worrying about that fuse box that might catch fire at any time and destroy all of those other cosmetic things that you see. So there's some things to think about. Humans, there's self-indulgent Mark with his self-indulgent, simply, practically human podcast. Session two of just having a bit of a ramble and a rant, and hopefully sharing some things with you that you find useful for you to not just look back at yourself, but perhaps look outwards as well and see what you see out there. Hey, if you love this one, get those thumbs out again, rate it 5 stars, and please leave us a review. I'd love to see some more reviews on the site. And if you liked it, share it with your friends. But till next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.